from the Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday evening, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this first edition of the Sunday Spin for the year 2020 on January the 12th of 2020. Welcome to our look at the world of politics and policy as we take you from City Hall to the State House and all the way on to the White House. So, as Mama says, it's 5 o'clock somewhere, so time to take a break. Maybe grab a little beverage, and we'll get you prepared for the rest of the week. Well, David, this weather yesterday was amazing. And you know, thankfully, we didn't get the snow.
No, that was a good thing. But a lot of people got hit with the water from the high waves driven by the high wind on Michigan, on Lake Michigan. And that was not pretty.
I mean, I was looking at my Twitter feed, and I follow Mike Hammernick, which I would suggest people do, because he's just all over this stuff. And he had, you know, video clips that people had sent in of the lake water, which was already, you know, at high levels. And then you get these humongous waves, and I can't imagine what the erosion damage costs are going to be.
There are a couple of beaches on the north side where they're saying we don't have a beach anymore,
right? And then you
couldn't see North Avenue Beach yesterday.
You see some of those, you know, where the bike paths were, that they were just chewed up.
Tore the pavement right up.
Right, right.
It's going to be, and they're talking about Lake Michigan hitting a record when it comes to the level this year, and it was a record level last year, wasn't it?
I believe it was. And remember, for before that, it was about how low the lake was, you know. But I think these are the real signs of the times right now.
It's going to be very interesting. If you look out the window behind you, there used to be a
Ferris wheel.
No. There was. I think it was part of an old pier that you used to be able to see.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's pretty much submerged.
Yeah, it's, well, I have to tell you, I'm kind of scared looking out the window right now, because I'm kind of still turned around from the old time of the show, so I'm almost like on a 12-hour reversal. I was watching the sun coming up through those windows now.
Be patient. In a few weeks, you'll be seeing the sun go down.
I hope so.
Patience. It'll all work out.
You know me better than that. Patience does not exist in my vocabulary. I mean, speaking of patience, my Blackhawks, I love my Blackhawks, but the other night, and David, you know I follow the Blackhawks intensely, but the other night, you know, this season has just been up and down, and I think it's clear right now, it looks like we're a 500 team, unless they get their act together. But the final straw for me of last week was the game against, a home game against Nashville. And Pekka Rinne is their goalie. And anybody who's a Blackhawks fan just has a natural dislike for Pekka Rinne. And, yeah, it's the end of the game. The Hawks are losing by 2 goals. Empty net from the Blackhawks goal. And Pekka Rinne, from behind the goal line, shoots the puck 185 feet and gets a goalie goal.
Yeah.
You know? Talk about it
just
in your face,
just rubbing it in a little more.
Just an in your face kind of thing.
It's just sticking the knife in and giving it a little twist. It's like, we got you. We got your number.
And, you know, and the thing is, goalies in practice do practice this, but you rarely get a chance to do it. And granted, Nashville was up already by 2 goals with 30 seconds.
He got his chance, and he took it.
First goalie goal in 6 years.
Hey, Kemp, you can't hate on him, because that's not easy to do.
Oh, I can hate on him.
Okay.
That's what hockey is. I mean, think about it. That's what it is. You can't I mean, I think it's a bigger factor than in football. Speaking of which, I was all prepared to give up on the Kansas City Saints at halftime today. I think it was...
You mean the Chiefs?
The Kansas City Chiefs, rather, yeah. I was ready to write them off.
4:53 to go, up 51-31.
And so that means they basically scored 48 points in the second half.
Uh-huh. Something, a switch went off somewhere, and it's like, we've got our act together now. Let's go do this.
It took long enough. It took long enough. Well, someone was suggesting that there was an idea that this was going to be a Mahomes and Aaron Rodgers, a Chiefs-Packers Super Bowl. So it would be the State Farm Bowl. Because that's... You don't think State Farm would love to have that? I mean, come on. Such is our sporting world today. What can I say? You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the WGN Skyline Studios on this Sunday evening. Well, this is my first time back in the studios at our new time, and I hope everybody has had a great holiday season. It was kind of nice, I think, for everybody, including myself, to take a little break away from politics and went out to Baton Rouge in Louisiana for some a little Cajun food and a little warmer weather. And speaking of Louisiana, I also picked up my LSU, Louisiana State, hoodie because tomorrow night is the big college championship game. LSU over Clemson, tomorrow night's college championship football game. I can't wait. I can't wait. Well, here on the Sunday Spin, Dave Jennings is here to keep us up to date on all the news. Producer Yasmin is here to field your phone calls at 312-981-7200. That's also our text line, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin, all one word. We're also on Twitter, @SundaySpin. And engineer Krista is here to keep me from getting lost in the studio as day turns into night instead of the other way around. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Up ahead on this edition of the Sunday Spin, we're going to spin through the headlines around the bottom of the hour, and then we'll speak to Jacob Meister. He's a Democratic candidate for the clerk of the Circuit Court of Cook County, which, of course, is now an open seat after Dorothy Brown's decision not to seek re-election. And we'll talk to him about his campaign and his ideas to improve the office. After a check of the news and sports at 6, we'll spend the next hour speaking to retiring Illinois Senate President John Cullerton. A Northwest Side Chicago Democrat, Cullerton is retiring after 40 years in office, and we'll speak to him about the changes he's seen in Illinois in politics and what the future of Illinois may look like. That's all coming up, but first it's time to spin through the last week in national politics, and we begin with what has been more than a week of tension between the U.S. and Iran following the death of Iranian Major General Qasem Soleimani in a U.S. airstrike. The president had said a major incident against the U.S. was imminent. On the talk shows, various representatives of the White House were less than clear what imminent meant. There are plenty of critics, and when a briefing of senators was held by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, some were outraged, and that included Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah.
The briefing lasted only 75 minutes, whereupon our briefers left. This, however, is not the biggest problem I have with the briefing, which I would add was probably the worst briefing I've seen, at least on a military issue, in the 9 years I've served in the United States Senate. What I found so distressing about that briefing was that one of the messages we received from the briefers was, do not debate, do not discuss the issue of the appropriateness of further military intervention against Iran. And that if you do, you'll be emboldening Iran. I find this insulting and demeaning, not personally, but to the office that each of the 100 senators in this building happens to hold. It is not acceptable for officials within the executive branch of government. I don't care whether they're with the CIA, with the Department of Defense, or otherwise, to come in and tell us that we can't debate and discuss the appropriateness of military intervention against Iran. It's un-American. It's unconstitutional, and it's wrong.
That's Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah. Also today, during the round of Sunday shows, various representatives from the White House said they would not go into the details of what they considered, what prompted the initiative against Iran, saying that they would reserve that and not present specifics to the Congress. So you've got Democrats who've questioned whether the attack was followed by a U.S. strategy or lack of strategy to deal with Iran. They questioned whether Trump was merely shoot from the hip, and Republicans contended Democrats were Soleimani sympathizers. Here's Georgia Republican Congressman Doug Collins on Fox News.
I mean, if it wasn't so sad and serious with our country to have Nancy Pelosi, I did not think she could become more hypocritical than she was during impeachment. But guess what? Surprise, surprise. Nancy Pelosi does it again, and her Democrats fall right in line. One, they're in love with terrorists. We see that. They mourn Soleimani more than they mourn our Gold Star families, who are the ones who suffered under Amazing. Soleimani. That's a problem. But also look at this. In 2011, when President Obama went into Libya and stayed longer than, quote, they thought, you know, the war power says he should stay, they said nothing. In fact, she actually excused it and said, this is just what, you know, presidents do.
So this is certainly kind of a question about Republicans, Democrats, and war. And this is one where you sometimes wonder whether Democrats got into a trick box here. When asked by CNN about Doug Collins' comments about Democrats being sympathizers, Illinois's junior senator, Democrat Tammy Duckworth, a disabled Iraqi war vet, had some sharp words towards the Republican congressman.
I left parts of my body in Iraq fighting terrorists. I don't need to justify myself to anyone.
I want to ask you, when he brings up Gold Star families and they become sort of like a pawn in this political discourse, I mean, what is your view on that?
I'm disgusted. I will never, ever use Gold Star families, military men or women, or their families as any pawn in any political game. Let me tell you something. This issue is about America's national security. It is not a partisan political issue. My concern is America safer today than it was before the president made this rash decision without considering the consequences and having a plan in place to handle the consequences? And my answer at this point is no.
Now, Duckworth, of course, you know, being a vet, is very outspoken on issues of war and war powers. And, you know, when she talks about Gold Stars being used as pawns, she went on in that CNN interview, there were reference to the fact of the president having criticized a Gold Star family. But Collins, the Georgia congressman, has since apologized for his remarks about sympathizers. But Duckworth also has had sharp words about Trump. And on the Senate floor, she issued a scathing denouncement of how he treats the military. And she likened him to a petulant child.
All these dictators and hostile regimes know. They've realized the same thing. The president of the United States is as easy to control as a toddler. Sweet talk him or thump your chest and issue a few schoolyard threats and you've got him. He'll fall for it every time, doing your bidding as if it is your own. I wish this weren't true, but my diaper-wearing 20-month-old daughter has better impulse control than this president.
And that's Tammy Duckworth, the Democrat Illinois junior senator. Now, everyone, of course, anticipated a reaction from Iran, and it came as Iran fired rockets into a U.S. military airbase in Iraq. No deaths or injuries were reported. And that was something that the president touted, as he also seemed to want to de-escalate and want to walk away from a potential war.
Should be extremely grateful and happy. No Americans were harmed in last night's attack by the Iranian regime. We suffered no casualties. All of our soldiers are safe. And only minimal damage was sustained at our military bases. Our great American forces are prepared for anything. Iran appears to be standing down, which is a good thing for all parties concerned and a very good thing for the world.
But there was apparently an unanticipated response, and that was the catastrophe. The U.S. military officials say Iran launched an air missile that blew up a Ukraine airline in Iranian airspace, killing everyone on board. The military suggested that it was inadvertent. So did Trump, and ultimately, Iran confessed.
It's a tragic thing. When I see that, it's a tragic thing. But somebody could have made a mistake on the other side. Could have made a mistake. It was flying. It was flying in, not our system. No, it has nothing to do with us. It was flying in a pretty rough neighborhood, and somebody could have made a mistake. Some people say it was mechanical. I personally don't think that's even a question, personally.
Now, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and House Democrats moved quickly to unveil a war powers resolution in an effort to control any administration escalation in dealing with Iran. However, it was a non-binding resolution. Here's Speaker Pelosi.
We have confidence in our case that it is impeachable, and this president is impeached for life, regardless of any gamesmanship on the part of Mitch McConnell. However, that could still come to bear. But we're confident in the impeachment, and we think that it is enough testimony to remove him from office. However, we want the American people to see the truth. And why are they afraid of the truth?
So if the Senate does not subpoena John Bolton and other witnesses, will the House move to subpoena
him? Well, it's not excluded. It's not excluded, but we'll see what they do. But we do think that there's enough evidence to remove the president from office. But we've done our job. We have defended the Constitution of the United States.
That's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi actually appearing on George Stephanopoulos' program, ABC's This Week, This Morning, defending the actions that she took to withhold the articles of impeachment from the Senate, despite wanting to move quickly in the House on impeachment. The fact being that she basically was attempting to try to maneuver Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell into a position of trying to, one, call witnesses, and two, lay out what he considers to be the rules of engagement for the Senate's impeachment trial. That didn't work. And there's still no word yet on whether McConnell will allow witnesses. The president has been kind of both ways on this. You have former National Security Advisor John Bolton saying that he's willing to testify in the Senate. You have the president saying that he would use executive privilege to block John Bolton from testifying in the Senate trial. It's all very much still muddled. Speaker Pelosi plans to meet with her caucus on Tuesday to lay out the groundwork for what's ahead. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on your Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with Jacob Meister, Democratic candidate for the clerk of the Cook County Circuit Court. That's up ahead. Right now, though, it's time for a spin of the headlines.
All right, Rick. Well, if you're watching the NFL, haven't been watching the NFL playoffs, Kansas City advances. They beat up on Houston. The final was 51-21. That game just coming to an end. Elsewhere in the news, we may be looking at another winter storm heading our way next weekend. People are still toting up the damage from the storms that have hit us already. And today, the start of a special week-long traffic enforcement. It is to make sure that people follow Scott's Law. Requires driver to slow down and move over to give room on the roads to emergency vehicles. Last year, 27 state police squads that were parked or stopped at the roadside helping motorists when they were hit by drivers who just would not move over. Rick.
Thank you, Dave, for that spin through the headlines. Right now, joining me here in the WGN Skyline studio is Jacob Meister, Democratic candidate for the clerk of the court of Cook County. And thank you so much for joining me this evening.
Well, thank you for having me, Rick.
And I hope you enjoyed the lovely nighttime views out here.
It is a beautiful night out.
Yes. No snow right now, thankfully. Thankfully.
Yes, this is good.
Jacob, I wanted to have you on, and I'm trying to do this before we get through the primary, of having some of the candidates in the contested races appear here on the show and give us their kind of, basically, their pitch for their vote. And obviously, when it comes to clerk of the Cook County Circuit Court, an open seat, Dorothy Brown having opted not to seek re-election. And I think there's a lot of frustration among voters about the clerk, the clerk's office, and the fact we know that, you know, she's been under this constant federal investigation, and ultimately one of her vendors, friends, employees, I'm not sure which, was basically, you know, chastised in federal court in a sentencing, saying, you know, you've covered up the prevented in federal investigation.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt that this office, the clerk's office, is challenged both operationally and ethically, and is really a ground zero of corruption in Cook County, and has been for some time. The office needs to be cleaned up. There's no doubt about it. You know, both, and I say both operationally and ethically, because operationally, you know, it's been called a patronage den of disappearing files and dinosaur age technology. And I think that hits the nail on the head.
Well, do you think, I mean, that's part of it is, because for how many, I almost want to say decades, have we heard about how the office is going to be upgraded? And how much of that was never done just to keep it as kind of a status quo political operation?
I think it is, and that's one of the reasons I'm running. You know, the Cook County Democratic Party is trying very hard to keep their, you know, keep their control on that office. We've seen a tidal wave in Cook County and Illinois of reform candidates getting elected in order to stop business as usual and bring about true reform, whether it's Fritz Kagi, whether it's Lori Lightfoot. The voters have made really clear that Democratic machine politics as usual is no longer going to be tolerated. And, you know, I'm the reformer coming in. You know, this is an office that's where you've got political interests, machine interests, who have been in control of jobs for decades, and they like it that way. But in order to modernize the office, we need to move away from a paper-based system. As much as some people would like to keep very large warehouses with lots of paper being moved around, in the real world, industry long ago embraced technology. We have to do the same thing in courts. We have to automate our docket systems and the way that our courts work. It's a shame that in 2020, on a daily basis, the way that business is done is judges and lawyers hand write out longhand all the orders, millions and millions and millions of them every year, in triplicate with carbon paper. And that has caused a crisis in our courts. Administratively, our courts, you know, the judges and lawyers can't navigate the system any longer. Files are getting lost. And it's tragic, you know, when you have a prisoner appeal pending and the appellate court can't get the record because the clerk's office has lost the file. You have hundreds of people sitting in prison right now whose appeals can't move forward. And that is a travesty of justice. And I want to make sure, you know, one of my main platforms is to increase access to justice and ensure access to justice for everyone. And access really means in a modern era that we have a modern operating court system with computer systems that can be relied upon. Whoever you are, a judge, a lawyer, particularly pro se litigants who are not represented by lawyers, who, with our current system, it is so bureaucratically difficult that an individual that's not represented can't navigate the system. They end up getting evicted or foreclosed on. They have child custody issues, you know, any myriad of things, you know, or they sit in jail because they can't navigate a system and get their paperwork filed because they can't figure out how to do it. And that's a travesty. We need to improve customer service. We need to bring access to courts. Frankly, when we go electronic, we can have access to courts in every neighborhood in the city by just training reference librarians in every library in the county so that people don't have to take off work to go down and file some paperwork. during a business day. They can do it on evenings and weekends right in their library and have somebody who's knowledgeable about how the online systems, how you upload documents into the online systems. So we really have to rethink fundamentally the way that our courts operate. We've been based on a paper system, moved to an electronic system, and that gives us the opportunity to do a lot of other changes in terms of how our work flows.
Remind me of what year this is again?
This is 2020, and right, we should have been doing it when Dorothy Brown came into office. She had a huge transition report, this whopping report, but with all these scholarly, you know, individuals who helped put it together in her transition team. And you pick up that report today and you realize most of what's in there still needs to be done.
I understand your push for more access for everyone, for fairness. But why haven't I heard from lawyers and judges in a very vocal way complaining about the state of the system?
Well, if you ask... You'll be stampeded if you ask a lawyer or a judge how does it operate. You just see them spitting and getting red because there is such a level of frustration. I've been practicing in the Cook County courts for the last 29 years as a lawyer. It is absolutely frustrating. You know I also practice in other courts around the country and the state, and you see what a good system works like, and then you work. And then you see what Cook County is. And Cook County is, there's almost a complacency that's come into.
Well, that's what I was wondering, if it's almost like inculcated in the system that people just are, lawyers and judges are just saying, well, this is the way it is.
It's kind of gotten to that because there have been so many promises made over the years of modernization that have never taken place. And really, that's what I bring to this election cycle. We've got an opportunity now. It's been 20 years with Dorothy Brown. We have a once-in-20-year opportunity to really elect somebody who's made it their mission to reform the office, modernize it, you know, make sure that we are keeping the political forces from playing with the operation of our court system, and you know, move to a merit-based hiring system, you know, make sure that Shackman principles are being respected and instituted.
You have Jeans Day.
I certainly want to make sure that this office, you've got a horrible morale problem among in the clerk's office.
I think it's very telling. You know, I mean that's the case there.
Yeah. There's a lot of very, very good employees in the clerk's office, and you know, don't get me wrong about that, who really deeply care about having an office that's accessible to everyone and that functions. But there's a level of frustration just from years and years of it being broken that I plan to come in. These are a lot of my friends. These are people I've known for years.
Plus, I want to say, you're an attorney. You've worked in that system. I'm sure you know what works, and you have your opinion of what works and what doesn't.
Absolutely. I realize that as we move over to a electronic system, it's going to require a lot of training, and I want to get paralegal certificates. You know, working with the City College of Chicago and our community colleges have a paralegal certificate in Cook County courtroom management so that we can make sure that we are training our folks so that they can do their jobs. Training under Dorothy stopped pretty much in 2004, and it's caused problems, and that's a source of morale problems. So you talk about Jeans Day, have at it. Let's have Jeans Day, you know, if that's something that is gonna make for a more collegial working environment. I want to do things to make sure that the folks who work in the clerk's office have respect for the office, but also have respect for what we're trying to accomplish, and we can work together as a team. So I won't charge for Gene.
That's well. See, when you said that, I was going to ask. You surprised me a bit there. I was going to say, really? No, but we're going to talk more about kind of the bigger picture of the office, as well as the bigger picture of the Democratic Party here in Cook County and in Illinois. In just a minute, we're going to take a quick break. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, joined here in the WGN Skyline studio by Jacob Meister. He's Democratic candidate in the competitive race for the clerk of Circuit Court of Cook County. That is the open seat as a result of Dorothy Brown deciding not to seek re-election. You had touched upon the voluminous transition volume, I believe, when
yes.
she... And actually, I did find this quote from... this was from her Chicago Tribune candidate questionnaire in the March 2000 Illinois primary. Quote, I will make certain that the clerk's office keeps pace with upgrades in technical equipment, and I will make certain that the employees of the clerk's office receive continuing education in operating and maintaining the office's information management system.
There you go. It's and you read through that report, transition report, which is quite a good document, but most of it has not been implemented and still needs to be done.
You've run for this office before,
yes,
and in fact, the last time you ran 4 years ago, there was consternation within the Cook County Democratic organization, not about your candidacy, but about her candidacy mm-hmm. and the effect that that could have on the Cook County Democratic ticket. Take a look at what the Cook County Democratic organization was 4 years ago when you ran against Dorothy Brown to what is the state of the Cook County Democratic organization in your view today?
Well, I think we've seen I think we're seeing the death of the Cook County Democratic Party, and I you know, even 4 years ago there was a weakening in the party's ability to coordinate, and today we've seen, I think, the erosion of the party. We've got Joe Berrios, who is the chairman of the Cook County Democratic Party, who lost overwhelmingly.
That was to Fritz Kegge for assessor,
and overwhelmingly, and the voters, in a pretty loud way, said we're not going to take machine politics and machine corruption as usual. And most recently, in the mayoral race, you know, the current chairman of the Cook County Democratic Party, Tony Preckwinkle, lost in the mayoral election. I think she got maybe 20 precincts out of 2,150 in the city of Chicago. And that was a resounding, proclamation from the voters that, once again, they're not taking politics, this Cook County Democratic machine politics, as usual. And I think that continues. We've seen just in the petition process that is...
To get on the ballot,
where the Cook County Democratic Party's signatures were absolutely atrocious. There's challenge to those petitions, and they filed relatively few compared to what the party normally does, and had well over half thrown out as bad. And that is a sign of a systemic weakness in the Democratic Party's ability to even get their own candidates on the ballot. And I think it's very telling that you have, what we see is we've got the old timers in the Democratic Party who really want it to stay the same. And we've got a whole new group who are coming up in our current committeeman elections. We have a reform movement of Democratic committeemen, a reform caucus of candidates all over the city who are rising up and saying we've got to change our party in very fundamental ways. And that you are going to see, over the next couple months, probably a dozen reform candidates in running for committeemen.
What do you attribute to that change from even say 4 years ago, or is it the Democratic Party in part of more of its progressiveness and that to move beyond kind of a controlled, strict organizational structure?
I think, you know, part of it is the corruption inquiries, you know, where we've got it's coming into focus to people that
it's not just the rule of business as usual.
Right. I think people are seeing what's happening with Madigan and his organization and Burke and his organization. And we saw with Berrios and his organization that there's a institutionalized pay to play system, patronage system that really operates to control our government in ways that we don't want, that makes our government offices dysfunctional for the sake of politics. And I think voters are starting to realize they need to get value for their money in government offices, and it's not just about lining politicians' pockets. And that's where I see the old and the new. I think there's a younger, more vibrant group of activists who want to bring about that change. We saw in the aldermanic races a number of new aldermen elected who have very bright line tests and say that the people who work for them are not permitted to engage in politics, and they're creating a bright line. Mayor Lightfoot, same thing. She's instituted, you know, if you're on the government side, you don't mix with politics. And that's a line that, you know, the machine likes to completely blur. They take, you know, patronage workers, put them in government jobs, and expect them to do politics, you know, political work in exchange for their jobs. And that's something that's got to come to an end.
Well, and as you mentioned, you know, one of the things you would make sure is, you know, making sure that the Chapman ruling on patronage would be, you know, ever present in the clerk's office.
Correct. You know, the office just recently became under Shackman control, and it's been a very rough ride. I see absolutely no reason why there shouldn't be full compliance. The principles, you know, that Shackman stands for are good government in my book, and so I don't think they'll have much problem with me getting full compliance. You know, it's just good government, and it's been many, many years in the making.
Just going back to what you were talking about with the Democrats and the people tired of same old, and being taken for granted in many respects. I mean, where goes the Democratic Party?
Well, you know, in this office, they're trying to put their machine guy in, and, you know, so he'll preserve and protect the old ways, the system, the patronage system. You know, he's a guy who's got a very troubling history of pay-to-play politics in his own role as on the Property Tax Board of Review, you know, taking money from the litigants and their lawyers who appear before him pretty openly and brazenly, over $1 million, you know, just in the last several years, from property tax appeal lawyers who appear before him and he rules on their cases. If that's not pay to play, I don't know what it is. It's Joe Berrios style government, and that's the stuff that's got to come to an end. So they certainly want people who are going to come into the clerk's office and maintain their status quo.
But I guess even to a larger point of, you know, if this is what the Democrats have been, is it even relevant to be a Democrat anymore and almost be more of try to be an independent Democrat, or if it were,
yeah,
such?
Well, I think it is independent Democrats. We kind of have two kind of parties. You've got your independent Democrats, and then you've got your machine Democrats. And there's always been a little bit of struggle and war between them. The principles that we all believe in, at least some of them, the progressive values, I guess, are similar. It's where we overlap. But the concepts of good government and reform, that's where I think we differ. And that's where I'm planning on making a difference in the operation and culture of the clerk's office.
Jacob, if people want to look at your campaign and the issues, you have a website?
I do. It's jacobforclerk.com. That's with an F-O-R. So it's jacobforclerk.com.
That's Jacob Meister. He is a Democratic candidate in the field that is seeking to replace Dorothy Brown as clerk of the Cook County Circuit Court. Of course, it's the primary, but it's tantamount to the general election is the Democratic primary on March 17th, St. Patrick's Day of all days.
Of course.
Yeah, nothing's ever easy in politics.
There's multiple reasons not to go to work. Go and vote and then have a good time.
Jacob, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to the Sunday Spin.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Up ahead on your Sunday Spin, we're going to spend the next hour speaking to Senate President John Cullerton. He's retiring after 40 years in the Illinois General Assembly. A lot of time there, seen a lot of things happen. We'll be speaking to him soon. Right now, though, time for the news.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to the second hour of your Sunday Spin at our new time. We're now 5 to 7 on Sunday evenings. And for the introductory evening launch of the show, I'm very happy to have as my guest John Cullerton, the Democratic President of the Illinois State Senate. Also, adding a parenthetical, retiring President of the Illinois Senate, retiring from the Illinois Legislature after more than 40 years.
Yes.
Mr. President, thank you so much for joining me this evening.
Happy to be here at your new time.
And I'm sorry the view isn't as bright as it is when it used to be on Sunday mornings.
If the folks who are listening to this radio show could be here, they could see a spectacular view of, it looks like there's a Ferris wheel.
Yes, there's a Ferris wheel there at the end of Navy Pier. The waves did not catch that yesterday.
Yeah, that's true.
Along with everything else that they were catching. Well, I wanted to have you on, and obviously I talked to you earlier and did a story in the Chicago Tribune about your time in the legislature. And I kind of wanted to start out with one of the things that I found most interesting, and that was when I talk to you about what's the biggest change in politics. And you went on to say that it was kind of a going to a direct democracy because of social media rather than a representative democracy.
Yeah, that expression was I heard somebody say that. It was a speaker at an event I was at, and it was a bunch of Senate presidents, and the Senate president from Rhode Island said, "How do we better communicate with our constituents?" And the speaker said, "You know, I want to hire you to go to your state capitol and learn and make decisions. I'm working here, you know, and do the right thing. And if you don't do the right thing, I'll have an opportunity to vote you out of office in a couple of years." And so he's the one that said, "So I want to have a representative democracy. I want you to represent me, you know." But what's the problem is, and this was, again, this guy wasn't even a politician. He was just making this observation that it's more of a direct democracy. So in the real world in Springfield, if I'm in a committee room and there's a bill that's up, and I think I know what's in the bill, but we haven't had the testimony yet, and I might say to one of my colleagues, "Hey, I really like you to vote for this bill." You've in this day and age, you have people saying, "Well, I can't vote for this bill." "Well, why not?" "Well, I already got 500 emails. I can't vote for this bill." "Well, wait a minute. Where did they come from? What did they say? What do they know? Listen to the testimony, you know?"
And that's the other thing, too, is you imparted so much importance on testimony in committee hearings as a critical part of the process that basically you're saying that doesn't matter anymore.
Well, it still matters, but it's lessening. That's the big difference, you know. And it's coupled, Rich, with the change in the lack of local reporting in what we do in Springfield too. So that's the bureau chiefs, you know, we used to have 50 in 1979, now there's about 3 or 4, and you don't have that local reporting. You do have,
and frankly it was very local. I mean, this is part of the, you know, what we've seen in the newspaper industry.
Exactly. A major problem throughout the whole United States.
I mean,
States,
you had, right? You know, the Alton paper had a
guy from Kankakee who lived in Springfield who reported on what we did.
For the Kankakee Daily Journal.
And then he would interview the guy from Kankakee and say, "What do you think about this bill?" And the local, I remember the people who were interviewed on television from media markets downstate.
Right.
They were like rock stars, you know, Rockford and Champaign. And I'm sitting next to them. They didn't seem like there was that special, you know. But their name recognition in their hometown was 95 because everybody knew, because there was local coverage about what we did. I mean, there's in Springfield.
And we should say, too, outside of Chicago, you know, being a state representative or state senator, that's a big deal.
Sure. In Chicago, because of the way the media works here, the aldermen are the ones who have been the big deal. And people don't know who their state reps are. Even being the Senate president, I suspect that I'm not as well known. Maybe a little bit more than most state senators, but not as well as some of the aldermen, you know. And that's also the history of the mayors and the governors in Illinois and the city of Chicago.
So is this direct democracy a failure?
Well, it's just the good and bad. I mean, people are, in a way, informed.
I mean, you want people to take part in their government.
Yeah, right. And they.
But you want them to do it in a knowledgeable
exactly,
way.
Exactly. Exactly. So it would be better if we had more informed folks about what we actually do in Springfield and what the issues are before they you know,
send the email.
Send the email and direct you to demand that you vote,
or sign a template from a special from some special group.
Another group that might say, you know what, should we call Cullerton and have a meeting to discuss our issue, or should we just go right ahead and picket him? Let's do the picketing. Because that's, you know, then we'll be on TV. So right. That's the other little problem we have as I leave.
Why are you leaving?
Well, okay, so I got married in 1979 to Pam Cullerton, and I also got sworn in 1979. So she and our marriage and my political career has coincided. And about 4 years ago, I got really concerned because my wife, out of the blue, announced that she was for term limits. And I said, are you referring to the marriage or to the political career? And she said, well, let's start with the political career, and we'll see how it works out. So we had a deal, and I was supposed to leave when I was 40 years in and 70 years old. That was the deal. And that was a big successful. When that happened, that was when we defeated Governor Rauner. I picked up 5 seats in the General Assembly.
We picked up
4 seats and added 5 women. And we had run out of money because we spent all the money to win those races. So I said, I negotiated for an extra year. And so I resigned, as promised, on the last day of that extra year. We had that great year with Governor Pritzker, working with the new governor, passed historic pieces of legislation. And it was perfect timing.
We're going to have to take a quick break here in just a minute. But when we come back, I want to talk to you about what you feel are some of the most significant achievements that you've seen, Republican and Democrats involved here as well, in those 4 decades here in Illinois. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, joined here in the WGN Skyline studio by John Cullerton, who is the retiring Illinois Senate president, the Democrat from the northwest side of Chicago. Before we went on the air, and I'd mentioned I'd written a piece about Senator Cullerton's tenure, and I got some comments from people that have a great deal of respect for you. I also got a lot of comments from people who said 40 years is too long. And this is the problem with the Democrats that control Illinois government. And that's how we're in this mess we're in. For some of those, I did point out that for a good number of years during your tenure, those were Republican governors.
Oh, yeah. I think 28 years.
Correct.
The first 28 years.
Yes.
Were Republican governors.
So that, you know, this automatic kind of attribute things to one side.
No, we had great years with Thompson, Edgar, Ryan being the governors. We had Democrats that controlled the General Assembly. It forced bipartisanship. There was, I think there were 2 years where Madigan wasn't the speaker or Lee Daniels was the speaker.
It was in the mid-90s.
And that had a kind of a big shift to the right a little bit, or not the right, maybe just more conservative things, and then that came back.
Well, that was the year of Chicago school reform.
That's true. And then I served 10 years in the minority under Pate Phillip in the Senate. So you learn when you're in the minority, and quite frankly, as a result of that, I think that's why I wanted to, you know, be a little more bipartisan than Pate was. And that worked out, which wasn't hard, by the way. But
that's why I laughed. Yeah, if anybody knows Pate Phillip, you'd be laughing
too.
Pate
was from DuPage County. I grew up out there, and I was one of those liberal Democrats. But you know, I worked with right now with Bill Brady. Before that, with Christine Madonio. Christine and I got elected the same day. We had to start working immediately together, first, unfortunately, on an impeachment trial, but then we got into the substance of a capital bill, which hadn't passed in 10 years. That was, you know, 10 years ago. So I think that, and the other thing that people should know is that 41 years is a lot of long time, but the average senator is there 8 years right now. The current average senator is there for 8 years, which is a mixture of people who've been there, who've got some institutional memory, and people who are brand new with fresh ideas. And that's why term limits don't work. They sound good. They're popular, but they don't work. We actually have the effect of what people want from term limits, a mixture of experience and new ideas right now.
Well, and before people say, well, you're saying that because you're a Democrat or whatever, I would like to point out John Shimkus,
yeah,
the dean of the Republican, right, members in the Illinois congressional delegation, who signed the Contract for America back, the Newt Gingrich, yeah, which included term limits,
yeah,
and he is now retiring, I believe, after 20 years,
yeah,
in Congress.
Yeah.
I mean, and I don't want to get into a debate about term limits or those kinds of things, but, you know, certainly we've seen during this period, and you talked about how with Republican governors or with one chamber or the other, or mm-hmm, if not both, in control of the opposite party, that it fosters bipartisanship.
Yes.
And to me, I think it also fostered a moderation.
Yes,
in politics.
I agree.
Rather than the far right and the far left. Right. And that's why I think Illinois for a long time was that kind of bellwether state.
Right.
But what made it change?
Well, politically, as I've more recently, of course, what's surprising is that, I grew up in DuPage County in Winfield, Illinois. My mom, of course, was the Democratic election judge. The first Democrat to apply for a ballot would be about 1:30 in the afternoon there in Winfield.
If they had them.
Yeah, and now they have, Winfield has a Democratic state senator. So there was a dramatic shift in basically because of Trump in the suburban America, but in that played out in DuPage County with a bunch
but
of
before
Democrats
Trump there. Illinois was it trended
true.
It had struggling trended Democrat.
Yeah. Well, what's happened is that the downstate has become more conservative, more Republican
and less population,
and people are leaving from not just Illinois, they're leaving from rural areas,
right,
all over America.
But less population in rural Illinois.
That's true.
And that affects their legislative representation.
It does. And as we've done these redistrictings every 10 years, there's fewer and fewer representatives from downstate because of those shifts.
So, but is Illinois a more progressive state?
Well, I guess using that term, today, I guess you'd say it is. It's moved to the left. There's certainly no question about it. I mean, we used to have.
Well, I mean, part of the reason I ask is obviously we're seeing once again, as we kind of saw in 2016, this debate being played out on a national stage about where goes the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And you know, certainly, I mean, to me, I was shocked in 2016 that the Hillary Clinton Bernie Sanders race
was a tie.
Yeah, basically a tie. Yeah.
I see that in the primary, in the polling for Iowa, which is coming up pretty soon,
right.
You see the Warren Sanders.
Warren
Sanders totals are almost equal to Biden and Buttigieg's polls. So we do have kind of the same kind of split between, you know, the more progressives and the more centrist. And we'll see how it plays out.
But you probably have that, too, within your caucus.
We do. We do. We've got some of the younger folks are a little more in that category. Certainly the city council has folks that openly say they're socialist, right? Which I would say is pretty far to the left.
I think so.
Yeah.
There were days when I couldn't ever imagine a candidate
to use that word.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right. Are you accusing me of being a socialist?
Right. Edward Murrow documentary.
So when I talk to folks about whether where I am on that spectrum, I think that people care about defeating Donald Trump, and people do not focus on the Electoral College. And the Electoral College is what it's all about, and national polls don't mean anything.
Right.
We don't care how much Bernie Sanders wins California by. You know, if it's not California, it's Wisconsin. It really is Wisconsin. So when you say, well, who do you support? Well, I support anybody that can get the folks who had voted for Obama
and then switch to Trump.
And if those are probably not people who are to the far left. So that argues for somebody who is a centrist to be the nominee.
Yeah, well, I mean, almost kind of the Reagan Democrat in some aspects.
Now the progressives say, no, the problem is that folks didn't vote, and we'll get energy, and we'll get folks to vote who otherwise wouldn't vote. Now, to me, the response is, well, you know, voting against Donald Trump, is, if you're a Democrat, is a pretty high motivation. You'd think that would get people to come out. So,
How did you run a caucus that's that diverse?
You know, I love our caucus, and we are diverse. We have an Hispanic caucus, up to 5. We'll probably add another one this year. We have Black caucus. There were 10 members of Black caucus. We have a downstate caucus, a suburban caucus. I'm really proud of the fact we have now 18 women out of 40. My replacement hopefully will be a woman, and therefore there'll be 19 out of 40, which is pretty cool. And that's
you
gonna
say hopefully
change.
Are you making
well,
an endorsement
Sarah,
here?
Sarah Feigenholtz
your replacement
would be my replacement
in the
Senate,
district.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the Senate president thing I'm staying out of. So I love the diversity. You know, I really do. And I work real hard. It's very personal. The people who are running for Senate president now are finding out that it's a really interesting, unique experience because it's extremely humbling. You're a peer with them, you're professional politicians, you are professional voters. And you ask somebody to vote for you, and, you know, they say, well, sure, I'm honored that you asked me, but is it just the two of us, or how many votes do we have here, you know, because you want to be on the winning side. And so that
well, and I like and I like the fact, when we talked about this in the story, was about the professional voter, that these are people, you know, who are voting on significant issues on a daily basis. So this
hundreds
is not
of times. Right.
Yeah, so
right.
This is not like a casual...
Right, and it's the most important thing. The job, by the way, I should tell you, that because of rules imposed on us by Pate Phillip, the job has a lot of power. So the Speaker and I have enormous... The rules give us enormous power. Everybody in Springfield works for us, for example. We appoint the committees that decide where the bills are going to be filed and all that. We just are given that. But if you abuse it, you'll be in trouble. So, but the point is, the power is there. And my style has always been to try to be, when I got elected, you know, you need 30 votes to get elected, but my strategy was to have a strategy of even the people that voted against me to keep them happy and keep them part of the caucus. And that played out this year, or last year, 2019, we kept everybody together in some major issues that were difficult to pass, but we were together.
Well, and also with the Senate, it's not like the House with 2-year terms. You have people that also have...
The 4-year terms helps in some cases.
Well, I mean, but there's a longevity factor that exists.
And your next election is right around the corners in some cases as well. That helps.
And you moved from the House to the Senate.
I was in the House for 12 years. Two of those years were in the minority, and when George Ryan was the Speaker, as a matter of fact. And then 10 years in the... I was 2 years with Phil Rock as President of the Senate. 10 years is with Pate, and then Emil Jones was my predecessor.
Well, I think I told you when I was asking you how you run your caucus, one of my great lines that I heard from Phil Rock was when he had some progressives that every morning when he got up to shave, he'd look into the bathroom mirror, take his razor, and go, do I shave or do I just slit my throat?
I know. He wrote a great book, too, the title of which was Nobody Ever Calls Just to Say Hello.
Correct. But certainly, I mean, there is a guy who goes down in history as one of the great leaders in Illinois.
Absolutely. Totally agree with you. I was honored to serve with him for 2 years.
We're speaking with John Cullerton, who is the retiring Illinois Senate President, Democrat from Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
It's always fun to give away radio station merchandise. Call in and win Blackhawks tickets Monday at 7:39. Bob Surratt, mornings, WGN.
America's oil and gas moves through 2.4 million miles of underground pipelines safely. But one of those pipelines were gone. We would need 90,000 more tanker trucks or 27,000 more rail cars every single day just to meet our energy needs. So, do you want this, this, or this? We move America's energy. We are Energy Transfer.
This is a Jackson Hewitt Tax Service announcement. Don't want to wait weeks for your tax refund? That's a reason to go to Jackson Hewitt Tax Service. File your taxes with Jackson Hewitt and ask a tax pro how you could get up to $3,200 fast with a no-fee refund advance. It's a 0% APR loan from MetaBank that's available before your tax refund is, so you could get money when you need it. Go to JacksonHewitt.com to learn about availability, terms, and how you could get money on a prepaid car fast, like today fast. Go to Jackson Hewitt today. That's Jackson Hewitt.
New year, new budgets. Every small business has unique needs. When you partner with a Dell Small Business Technology Advisor, you get real-time, tailored advice. They'll even give you a free audit on your servers and storage devices to develop a custom solution to help improve your company's productivity. Plus, right now, upgrade to Windows 10 and get up to 45% off select business computers with Intel Core processors. To speak with a Dell Advisor, call 877-BUY-DELL. That's 877-BUY-DELL.
My New Year's resolution is to drink more Papa Nicholas coffee and maybe do some squats.
Shop at PapaNicholas.com or at your favorite local grocer.
When you put money in the Salvation Army's red kettles, you're giving someone in addiction recovery the gift of hope, or a senior a hot meal, or a family a warm place to sleep. You're providing love and compassion every day. People turn to the Salvation Army to help keep the heat on, put food on the table, and keep their children safe from harm. Every day, you make it possible for the Salvation Army to give that help. Every year, the Army serves more than a million people throughout Chicagoland. They provide housing, cure hunger, combat addiction, and so much more. Thank you to the WGN listeners who donated to our online kettle. And a special thanks to these fine Chicago area businesses. Papa Nicholas Coffee, MyPillow.com, Permaseal, Lindeman Chimney, Next Door and Window, the Joint Relief Institute, and Team Hochberg at 56David.com. Give hope to a neighbor in need. The mission continues now. Click the donate button at salarmychicago.org/WGN radio.
It's 6:32 on this Sunday evening. Time for a spin through the headlines. Off to you, Mr. Jennings.
All right. Thank you very much, Rick. One of the Democratic candidates wants to be the new clerk of the Cook County Court. Jacob Meisner says one of the things that the system needs, the office needs badly, is to get it into the 21st century, at least, when it comes to record keeping, and say goodbye to, well, carbon copies. Secretary of Defense Mark Esper says he has seen no hard evidence that four American embassies have been under possible threat when President Trump authorized the targeting of Iran's top military commander. Lots of protests, anger, and outrage on the streets of Tehran today. That is because citizens are unhappy about the government initially not admitting the truth that it was their military that shot down that Ukrainian Airlines passenger plane. In another embarrassing sign, Iran's only female Olympic medalist said online that she's defecting to move to the Netherlands. Closer to home, authorities say they use social media to help identify 43-year-old Demon Reed. They arrested him and charged him as a suspect in the theft of $50,000 worth of diamonds in the north suburbs. He is currently behind bars. Your forecast: freezing drizzle, expected through the late and overnight hours into tomorrow morning. Low in the low 30s, and for Monday, cloudy, a chance of freezing drizzle for the morning commute, and the daytime high around 40 degrees. Right now, it is 30 degrees at O'Hare, 32 Midway, same in Gary. Lake water temp at 35, it is 31 at the lakefront. Rick?
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Thanks, Dave, for the news update. Much appreciated. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Joining me here in the WGN Skyline studio, retiring Illinois Senate President John Cullerton. And we're talking about his 40-year tenure in the Illinois General Assembly. Leadership, what the future of the Democratic Party is. Let's talk accomplishments. Again, during that time span, I mean, certainly last year, a lot got done. And part of that, I think, was a part of a repressed legislature after 4 years under Bruce Rauner. But, I mean, also, I think it very much pointed to this more progressive Illinois that we're living in right now.
That's true. This last year was. Well, over my 41 years, though, I've when I first got elected, I was one of those lakefront liberals. So I was viewed as the progressive one back then. And in terms of what I got involved with early on, I had been a public defender. I knew a little bit about criminal law. But as I said, my wife and I got married in 79, and we had our first baby in 81. And back then, there was only one state in the nation that had a child passenger safety law. And I vividly remember driving home with that first child with Pam holding her in the front seat. And then it was only a few months after that, my wife actually learned about car seats, started a loaner program out of our house, and then I was sponsoring the bill to require people to have their kids in car seats. And we became the second state to pass it. And that led to me sponsoring the seatbelt law. And the interesting thing about that was, at the time we passed the seatbelt law, only 15% of people were wearing a seatbelt. So from a political point of view, you're standing up on the floor of the House and you're trying to force 85% of your constituents to do something they're not doing. It's not that easy to do.
And I think that was even before the federal funding component.
It was. In fact, that came, Elizabeth Dole was the Secretary of Transportation, that came after that. And, you know, obviously eventually that would have passed, but we passed it early and we saw the fatality rate, you know, drop. It also was a lesson on how you start off with half a loaf. Start off with a bill, get it on the books, only applies to, you know, it's a secondary offense and only applies to you and your own car and that sort of thing, and then you keep on expanding it. In fact, I did expand that when Obama came along. I helped him with his racial profiling bill. He helped me with my seatbelt law that made it a primary offense. So that was something I'm very proud of. I later on got involved in graduated driver's licenses for kids under 18. So highway safety was a big deal, and it's rewarding because you can literally push a button, a green button, and say, I'm going to vote for a bill, and you know you're going to save like hundreds of lives.
But you could never get that motorcycle helmet bill.
And that's a great point, because that had been declared unconstitutional in Illinois. They had passed it, believe it or not, in, I think, maybe 61 or something like that. Ogilvie was the governor. And it had been declared unconstitutional when my seatbelt law was challenged in court, found to be constitutional. And I said, oh, now I can pass the helmet law, only to find out that, no, there's 250,000 people who do not want that bill passed. And after a few years of trying, I finally said, you know what, guys, you're on your own. Let those who ride decide if you want to take chances. It's wildly more dangerous to not wear a helmet. Problem being, though, that we're the ones that pay for it. And the Illinois Rehabilitation Institute is filled with folks who didn't wear helmets.
And it's the taxpayers' money.
Exactly. And that, by the way, is also my obsession with smoking. I've never smoked.
I wanted to go there.
I
want you to explain the story about this year's budget and the governor's first budget proposed.
The governor was trying to find money for a capital bill, and he proposed a 25 cent tax increase on cigarettes. And I worked closely with the advocates of cancer, heart, lung associations, and they said they would be neutral on that. And I said, well, that's kind of crazy. Why? It's a tax on cigarettes. They said, unless it's a dollar, it doesn't change behavior. Because if you gradually raise it, people just kind of get used to that. If you hit them with a dollar, And they have statistics, which are national statistics, because there's so many different places where you have these taxes, that are accurate. Like 28,000 kids will not, you know, will quit, won't start, and 32,000 adults will quit if you do the dollar. So I just insisted on it. And at the end of the day, negotiating the last day with Jim Durkin, actually, in a bipartisan effort, I got a 15% tax on e-cigarettes.
In addition to the dollar.
So not only is it money that helps initially pay for the capital bill, as people stop using those products, hopefully, you save enormous more in Medicaid costs, because a disproportionate amount of Medicaid folks, who we pay billions to, are smokers, unfortunately. So it has a real positive effect, and that's something which, again, it's health and money saved at the same time.
I want to ask you about the pension debt.
Yeah.
And there's blame on all sides.
And a lot of hyperbole and a lot of misunderstanding, because it is complicated.
And you did make the effort under the Quinn administration to try to make a change in pensions.
Let me just give you the first thing that people should know, and this is really important, is that we don't get any credit for this, we passed a major pension reform back in, you know, now it's been like 8 years, 9 years ago, where all new employees going forward have a real Spartan pension.
Spartan, if almost not unconstitutional.
Not unconstitutional, but it's a pension that's not anywhere as generous as what we had before. And that saved billions of dollars over time. And we stopped the bleeding when we passed that. And it's over half the school teachers, over half the state employees, over half the university employees who now are on that tier two pension. The tier one pension, we 26 years ago, said we're going to have to catch up on our payments that we had underfunded and that we had done before. And for the most part, we have stayed with that schedule. And if we keep on doing it for 25 or 24 more years, we'll be 90% funded. So it's not that the pension system is bankrupt or going bankrupt. It's actually the opposite. It's just that it's a lot of money. The problem is it's just a big portion of our budget that we have to spend on pensions.
25%.
What I did was find a way with a brilliant attorney that helped me out, Eric Madera. He told me that if you do it a certain way, called a consideration model, it'll be constitutional. You can limit people's – they can, in effect, voluntarily limit their future pensions in exchange for something now. And we passed that in the Senate twice. Mm-hmm. We passed it when a competing unconstitutional version was advanced in the House. We said, this is constitutional, doesn't save as much money. And we got beat up. We got beat up by I remember the Tribune editorial board said, oh, that doesn't save enough money, so your bill's wrong. Well, guess what? That bill, which we eventually passed, was found unconstitutional, unanimous by the Supreme Court, and our pension bill didn't pass. And it's still out there. And if anybody wants to vote on it and pass it, it'll save a bunch of money.
Well, I mean, obviously pensions are always a major topic here.
Because of our Constitution says, right, once you get it, you can't.
But I'm still constantly, and again, I'm not a lawyer, not a constitutional lawyer, but those who say, well, just change that pension protection clause and then we fix everything.
There's a real simple answer to that. It's called the federal constitution, and they have a thing called the contracts clause. So that once you get your benefit in Illinois, you are protected. Even if we change the pension in the provision in the constitution, you'd still have the federal constitution's contract clause to say, no, I still get to keep my pension. And we've already taken care of the new hires by passing Tier 2. So that constitutional amendment in Illinois wouldn't do anything, in my opinion.
Well, and as well as, isn't it like post facto, too, that you start?
Well, it would help you in the future if you want to reduce future people's pensions. But it doesn't help this problem of paying off these Tier 1 pensions as people are retiring. That's who we're paying out. And it came from a real bipartisan mistake of giving too generous a provision, probably, one would argue.
During a time of high inflation.
It was high inflation. We had a 3% compounded COLA. It didn't even seem like that much when inflation was 7 or 8%.
And I think Jim Thompson was governor.
He might have been the last, that was his last year, I think, when we signed that. So it's a bipartisan problem to get into, but it's not in any way something that can't be solved, in my opinion.
We're speaking with Illinois Senate President John Cullerton. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the WGN Skyline studio with retiring Illinois Senate President John Cullerton, kind of going a little bit what's ahead for Illinois as well as a little bit memory lane. Mm-hmm. Most colorful character that you dealt with.
Oh, God, there's so many colorful characters. But
there aren't as many these days.
Well, that's true. But I have to say that, you know, what was pretty cool was spending 8 years with Barack Obama. I mean, the guy, I tell this to any legislator, I mean, from other states, too. I say, can you imagine sitting next to a guy and he gets to be the president of the United States? I mean, it was really neat. And, you know, when Barack was there, he was real bright, but you just didn't figure he was going to be the president. You might
no one
higher
did.
Office, something like that. And I worked with him on a lot of bills, worked with him on death penalty reform bills. I mentioned the bills dealing with seatbelts and
right.
stuff like that. So that was a lot of fun. But yeah,
seeing him debate Peter Roskam.
Peter Roskam, that's right. He was the floor leader for the Republicans and
congressman. All different. I'm going to have to ask about the current state of the Democratic Party, particularly Democrats in Springfield. We've got issues involving House Speaker Madigan, mm-hmm. People surrounding him. In your caucus, there's been investigations of a couple of former members and a current member.
Mm-hmm.
Is it just because this kind of stuff is systemic?
You know what? It's really sad. I was totaling up the number of folks that I've served with in 41 years in both the House and the Senate. It's 987 people that I've served with. And, I mean, overwhelming majority of those people, super majority of those people get elected. And they're Republicans and Democrats to do the right thing. And so it's really embarrassing when just so few but any people get in trouble. There's been folks over time that have gotten in trouble in their own private life, just like there is in people who work at radio stations. You know, they get in trouble. But for people who actually do something wrong as it relates to the legislature, that's really embarrassing because as an institution, I love the legislature. So now, I also, you know, I was a public defender for 4 years and 5 years at the 26th in California. I do believe in the presumption of innocence, that if people are going to plead guilty, they're admitting they're guilty. And that's pretty straightforward. If somebody says they didn't commit the crime, I'd like to, you know, hear them out and see what happens to the justice system. But just being charged is really a and as we said, when we're not getting any local coverage from what we actually do, or even the positive things, there's no reporters down there. When something like this happens, everybody flocks there. They cover the scandals, and because it's more interesting. And yet, at the same time, it kind of gives us a stain, which, you know, it's unfortunate.
I do want to ask you about the email from Mike McLean, who was a close confidant, a longtime lobbyist in Springfield, close confidant of Speaker Madigan, certainly his closest confidant, and this allegation of involving a rape in Champaign and ghost payrollers for another person. And I'm not going to get into what it might mean or what it doesn't mean, except for the fact of, I guess, the question of the brazenness.
Yeah, well, look, there's an email that talks about two things which are crimes, and they should be investigated. And the guy who wrote them seems like he's aware of them. So a criminal, not a legislative investigation, a criminal investigation ought to focus on what Mike McLean knows about those crimes. And that's what ought to happen right away. I don't know that you attribute it. And I know that there's people, it's true that he's friends with Madigan. But I don't think that email has anything to do with Madigan. It's a local guy down in Quincy where Mike McLean's from. He's concerned about the guy.
Well, he's not just a local farmer. I mean, he's very powerful.
He is, but my point is that could be something that he in his own world. He's a former legislator.
Yes.
He would have known the people he's sending the email to. That's something he could have been doing on his own without the speaker having any knowledge of it, is all I'm saying. That's my first reaction. But people want to link.
Well, I think part of that linkage is the fact that at times people, and you could make this statement about the speaker himself, about an arrogance or a smugness of
people around
him.
Well, I've negotiated. I know Mac Madigan very well, and he's a very,
I mean,
very
yes,
bright
you,
guy.
Obviously.
And we you know, by people should understand that you can't pass a law unless it's the identical language passes both chambers. So institutionally, you have to work with the other person, and that's what I've been doing in the last 11 years. Now, sometimes he's very difficult to deal with. He's a very good negotiator, and we don't agree with on everything, but we have to, at the end, compromise, and I've done that. But after we do that, I don't have a press conference and announce it. We work it out, and he's a very hardworking person. And don't forget, Bruce Rauner spent tens of millions of dollars calling him a crook with no evidence because he didn't like him politically. So, you know, he's been demonized, I think, unfairly. He's very difficult sometimes to deal with. He knows that. But we always seem to work things out. I just don't see any, connection here between this latest email incident and Madigan that is obvious. That's all.
So what's next for you?
Well, I've been a lawyer at the law firm of Thompson Coburn, which is a big law firm in St. Louis. Actually, it's the largest law firm in St. Louis. We have a Chicago office. But my job as Senate president and running the campaigns every 2 years with all the fundraisers, I go to 70 fundraisers a year and that sort of thing. It doesn't leave much time for practicing law. So now I'm going to be able to focus on that. And we do have the proverbial fantastic grandchildren who live three of them that live within a mile of our house, and they're over all the time. And that's why my wife probably said, term limits for... I was recently in St. Louis, by the way, and with the Missouri legislators, where they have term limits. I think it's 2 months, and you have to be out.
2 months.
Yeah, and I said that I was retiring because in Illinois we have a tough 41-year term limit rule. I also told them that I'm from Chicago. These are Missouri legislators in the city of St. Louis, and I told them I'm from Chicago, from the north side, and I represent a place called Wrigley Field. So they stood up and started booing.
Yeah, I would expect right. That
Cardinal
had,
fans.
They had to go over.
Yeah.
But I mean, you made a point in talking to me for the story about. About traveling around the state and how important is for your successor as Senate president, but also how it ought to be de rigueur for any member of
my
the General
God.
Assembly.
We had so much fun traveling, and Pam would come with me a lot of times. We had a guy named Gary Forby, who was a Democratic senator, who I actually knew I'd stayed maybe too long because I actually understood what he was saying.
Yeah, for folks who don't know Gary Forby, I'll be playing a tape of him next week, so you'll understand.
Okay. That's great. But down in Carbondale, the Ducoyne State Fair, I mean, it's fantastic. And I would go over to Rock Island and campaign for members there. We have Democrats on the Wisconsin border, and you know, traveling around the state. Quincy itself is a fantastic town. So now the driving back and forth from Springfield now it's up to 4 hours, by the way, because of the traffic. So round trip,
really,
it's 8 hours. So that's what it's like for one day.
Mile marker bingo on I-55.
That's right. It's 57 is faster now. That's how
you know, people
say
but I mean, I've always said the great thing about this state is the diversity. And when you have these goofballs talking about the separatist movement.
Oh, my God. If they separated the Southern Illinois from Northern Illinois, their economy, the Southern. Actually, I forced them to call it Northern Kentucky. So we'd call the new state Northern Kentucky, not Southern Illinois. And they wouldn't have any money because, we provide so much more. So it's just unfortunate.
But playing off against Chicago has always been a traditional campaign thing.
Absolutely.
And you understand it, and you allow your members to, rail at you if right. possible.
We would give money to candidates down in Southern Illinois to say how bad Chicago is, Democratic candidates, so they can get elected.
Right.
Yeah. But then...
But what has sent this into this weird sphere?
Well, I mean, it's just... We're not as bad as things have happened at the national level. I mean, it's social media. There's a whole bunch of different theories, obviously. It's why things are so polarized. But the states... The states have still have to get stuff done. There's only one state in the nation that has a divided chamber between the House and the Senate. That's Minnesota. So every state in the nation, the House and the Senate, is either both Democrat or Republican. And the governors could be from different parties. And they have to get stuff done, and they work together. The federal government, for another show.
That's what I'm afraid of. Yeah. We're speaking with John Cullerton. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. In a few closing seconds, Senate President John Cullerton, I want to thank you so much for giving us the time this evening to reflect on your 40 years of service, and I hope your phone will still be open in case I need a call for your thoughts on anything.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, that's a wrap on our first Sunday Spin of 2020 at our new time, which will be 5 to 7 p.m., except when preempted by my beloved Blackhawks. And so there'll be a few shortened shows ahead, but as we come up through February and into March, we're going to be on a lot as we get closer to the March 17th St. Patrick's Day primary in Illinois. We'll have a lot of candidates on. We'll have a lot of people with all the information you need to decide how to cast your primary ballot. So stay tuned in the future for the Sunday Spin. Karen Conti is up next after the news with Legally Speaking. I'm Rick Pearson. Good evening.